Greetings and welcome to the Recombobulation Area Podcast. My name is Dan Schaefer. Thank you for joining us. I am at the Democratic National Convention, and here in Chicago, there is a lot going on. Most of this is taking place inside the United Center, but there are other events happening all over town. Yesterday afternoon, I attended one of those events, hosted by an organization called the Next 50, a group that focuses on the next generation of Democratic leaders, with a particular focus on those in state legislatures. The event was called the Reverse Coattails Roundtable, and it featured several state legislative leaders from swing states, including Senator Mallory McMorrow from Michigan, State Representative Sam Park from Georgia, and Greta Neubauer, the Democratic leader in the Wisconsin State Assembly. After the event, I had the chance to sit down for a conversation with Neubauer. We talked about reverse coattails and how races at the bottom of the ticket might help candidates at the top. We talked about the changing enthusiasm for Democrats with Kamala Harris as the nominee, and we talked about Tim Walz and what he and Democrats have been able to do with a one-seat legislative majority in Minnesota. We also talked about new maps and the chances for Democrats to win the majority in the Assembly. She thinks it can happen. She even predicted that they'd win 52 seats. We also talked about the Republicans like Robin Voss advancing more constitutional amendment referendums. We also talked about what legislative Democrats have done in Wisconsin to protect the governor's veto during the most recent session. We talked about a lot more, too. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Democratic Assembly Leader Greta Neubauer. Let's recombobulate. So reverse coattails. Tell me about how reverse coattails is going to matter for us with new maps.
Yeah. So we have seen in the districts that are newly very competitive, Sheboygan, Wausau, Hudson Sea, real enthusiasm in those communities. People are so excited to be able to participate in an election at this level, at the legislative level, that is competitive. Couple folks I like to talk about, Yilin Zhang and Wausau, you know, just an amazing candidate, been in office since he was in high school, incredible enthusiasm for his campaign. He's a Hmong leader, would be the first Hmong representative. And we are just seeing volunteers come out of the woodwork to help him in that race. Again, people who've been really frustrated because they know that there are enough voters in that area that it should be competitive for Democrats. But it just hasn't been the case for 10 years. Sheboygan, often litigants in the redistricting cases from Sheboygan because it was such a classic example of gerrymandering. And Joe Sheehan, who's running there as 20 plus year school superintendent, ran the economic development chamber, just a really well-known community leader. And we had folks out knocking doors with him last week who were saying that they came across a number of Trump Sheehan voters. So we are just finding these great candidates who are well respected in their local community, who have a lot of relationships, who are able to bring out new volunteers. And then they're talking to voters who are really excited about, you know, being one of, again, being in real, participating in a really close election. Many of these legislative races will probably be decided by a few hundred votes. There are so many close districts under these maps, 10 seats, where if you layer on Biden's results from 20, it would be 2 percentage points plus or minus for Biden. So that means that those are districts that can be won or lost on the doors. Our candidates understand that, the voters understand that. And the last thing I'll say is just that I do think that candidate-to-voter conversation is really important. We, of course, are going to do everything we can to give our candidates air support with mail and digital and, in some cases, television. But we all know Wisconsin voters are going to be absolutely flooded with media over the next couple of months. What can break through that is the actual candidate at the door saying, I want to represent you. What are the issues you care about? Here's what I'm going to do about those things. And so our whole campaigns really are designed around getting the candidate to talk to as many voters as possible.
So with those conversations that you're having on the doors, one, how have those conversations changed in the past 6 weeks, going from Joe Biden at the top of the ticket to Kamala Harris at the top of the ticket? And then second, how do you feel like those conversations can then impact the top of the ticket? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're here at this, you know, reverse coattails roundtable. How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, so the conversations are different. I have been knocking on doors in my own district. It's a new district to me, a lot of it, about 65% new, so I wanted to get out and introduce myself to those new voters. We're knocking on true persuasion doors right now. These are people who we don't know how they align politically, or we've never spoken to them before. And I was having a lot of conversations that started out with Biden's age. Even when I was saying, hi, I'm your new representative, my name's Greta, here's some of the things I've been working on. One of the first things that I was hearing back was some concern about both people who were the options for the presidency. And of course, those conversations have really shifted. I find that we're talking now much more about the future. We're not relitigating two past presidents. We're talking about what Kamala Harris has to offer. I am finding a lot of enthusiasm and people who are actually asking me how to volunteer on the doors. And we, you know, are certainly seeing with women, with young voters, with voters of color, you know, real identification with Kamala and real excitement that she could be their president. So that is a very exciting thing. There are certainly still a lot of persuadable voters out there, a lot of people I talk to who say they haven't made their minds up, and that's why we keep knocking on the doors and having those conversations. So your second question.
Well, I guess how those direct conversations can, you know, impact throughout the ticket for Baldwin, for Harris.
Right.
For
so
else.
I think what we're seeing now, right, is real consolidation of Democrats for Harris. So I did have some conversations in the spring with voters on a Democratic list who said they had concerns about voting for Biden. We're not having that anymore, right? Those folks who identify as Democrats, they're voting for Kamala Harris. And then what that allows us is to really focus on those folks who are actually undecided, those people who are still getting the news, thinking about their choice. Often these are voters who pay less attention to politics, right? These are people who often are raising costs at the doors, and they really do want to hear what our plans are to address those things. And it's different when I can say, actually, yeah, we have a bill on childcare that we would like to pass next year if we're able to do that, and that will increase availability and lower costs. It cuts through in a different way than a mailer arriving at the door for Kamala Harris or for our candidates. And so I think what we're going to be able to do for the top of the ticket is find those folks who are disillusioned with politics in general and hopefully bring them back into voting. And if they show up to vote for Yiling Zhang or Do Xian, they're probably going to be voting for the rest of the ticket as well.
So Tim Walz is speaking tonight at the DNC. You mentioned during your remarks before that you had a chance to speak with him recently.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that conversation and about how, what he's been able to do and what Democrats have been able to do in Minnesota? Could that provide a template for Democrats in Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. So I met Tim Walz at the Eau Claire rally, incredible energy there. And of course, it was sort of him welcomed in Wisconsin. There were a few folks I think who drove across the border too to attend that one, but people were thrilled to have him. And I think many people in Wisconsin look at Tim Walz and they see sort of their favorite coach or teacher or uncle or, you know, somebody they know from church or something like that. So a lot of identification, I think, of Wisconsinites with Coach Walz. What I said was, we're working for the majority this year in Wisconsin. We have a real path in the assembly. And he said, you only need a majority of one to get amazing things done. And, you know, we have seen that in Minnesota. You know, many of us have family or friends. My mom's from Minnesota, who look to our neighboring states of Minnesota and Michigan, see the recent trifectas, and see that they really have been able to meaningfully improve people's lives in those states. People who were in poverty who are not, kids who did not have free school meals who do, rights protected that were under attack, women's rights, workers' rights, and more. So that's just been a really amazing thing to see. And I think we certainly identify with those states. They're neighbors to us. They're not so different. The reason that Wisconsin is behind is because we were the right wing's testing ground, and the gerrymander and these attacks on voting rights really allowed Republicans to consolidate power in a serious way. And we have now been digging out of that hole for a number of years, but have finally sort of crossed onto the other side of having a functioning legislative contests, right? Real competitive districts. And it's just a very exciting time. We look to these other states too, in terms of how quickly they were able to move and how effective they were in consolidating around top priorities and then passing those into law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you obviously sat next to Senator McMorrow for mm-hmm. that panel here. What types of things, you know, do you think you might be able to learn from her, you know, just in your yeah. individual interactions, but also just from what they've done in Michigan as well?
Yeah, so I've been speaking with the leaders in Michigan, Minnesota, and Pennsylvania, actually. And there are a number of things that we all have in common. Our states have some similar dynamics. We're all battlegrounds. We're in the spotlight again this year.
I was going to say, what could it be that right. you all have in common?
Yes. Yeah. but they've been able to make some real gains. In the House, in the Assembly in Michigan, they have another similarity to us, which is that they had about a 50% new caucus last cycle, and that's the situation we're setting up for as well.
Right.
So we've been talking to them about how they prepared to govern, hoping and working towards a majority, but not having it yet, with all of these new people coming in. And so I have been picking their brains about that and figuring out how we can start working through these really detailed policy questions to be prepared for January. But certainly hearing about the messages that they hit on in their races, the themes that were resonating with voters, the structure, the organization that they had is really helpful. We, of course, are very lucky in Wisconsin. We have a really strong state party. The governor is very invested in state legislative work. And so we do have really an amazing operation this year that I think is providing fantastic supports to our candidates in these targeted seats. But it is a lot of seats for 1 year. And so, you know, always more work to do to make sure that they are talking to voters and making sure their message gets out there.
Mm-hmm. Those constitutional amendments mm-hmm. that you talked about mm-hmm. and that, you know, I think democratically aligned voters shot down last week
yeah.
in Wisconsin. First, what was your reaction to the results when you saw them last Tuesday? And then you're also, if you could expand on your reaction to what Speaker Voss had to say about the Republicans wanting to continue on the path to do more of these types mm-hmm. of constitutional amendments.
Republicans in Wisconsin, particularly in the legislature, got used to being able to compete on an unfair playing field. They talk about how they have great candidates, but we're going to see how their candidates stack up in actually fair districts. And they also changed the rules for funding campaigns so that they would be able to accept unlimited contributions from individual donors, so that they would be able to outraise and outspend Democrats, many of whom were funding their campaigns with grassroots work. They are now experiencing the Democratic Party being able to counter them, right? And being able to push back and being able to actually compete in every way that Republicans have for a number of years. And so it's just a very exciting moment, of course, for us to see all of the work. I often, when I'm talking to folks locally, talk about how going into those county party offices, right, in the winter, maybe in February, before those spring elections, or in August, as people are slogging, knocking on doors, right, those persuadable voters before a fall election, people kept doing the work, the grassroots kept showing up and knocking on doors and working to flip Supreme Court seats and the governor's race and win the governor's race and protect the veto, even though they didn't know how it was going to turn out and that we were ever actually going to get to this moment where Wisconsin could be on a new path. And so what I see in the constitutional amendment votes this August was all of that bearing fruit. We have the right message. We have resources to put behind that. For many years of building up so many ways of reaching voters and reaching donors. And then we've got the grassroots infrastructure with hundreds of organizers already on the ground talking about every level of the ballot and the constitutional amendments. What I found knocking on doors was over the last month before the election, we went from people not really knowing they were on the ballot or understanding them to people understanding them.
Mm-hmm.
Democrats got the message that these constitutional amendments were a power grab by Republican legislators, and people in the middle also got that message. And it turns out they didn't really like it, and they thought that it was not a good thing. I heard from a colleague about a conversation with a Trump voter on the doors who said, in a crisis situation, I actually want resources to be able to go out quickly from the federal government. And even I know what the Republican legislators will do if they're able to muck up the process. And so it's really powerful, I think, for all of us to see that voters do understand what Republicans have been up to, and they are tired of the power grabs. We also saw really great turnout overall, which is an exciting thing for us for November, because we need enthusiasm to be high. We need voters to turn out everywhere, and that's what we saw on election night.
Yeah, and then with Voss too. Do you think that his comments about wanting to do more of these constitutional amendments, how do you think that's going to play out?
So Republicans understand that the gerrymander has protected them from the will of the voters. And they are going to do everything that they can to make use of that gerrymander for as long as they can. They made that really clear in the last 2 years where they tried to fight fair maps at every turn. Thankfully, they were not successful. But they hope that they will be able to hang on for one more term with these majorities and be able to put policies in place that allow them to have an advantage long term. We have voter ID in law. They want it to be in the Constitution because they know that it benefits them. They know that it suppresses the votes of people who historically have voted democratically, including young people and voters of color and low-income voters. And so it's really important that we don't allow them to do that. They are going to pass a constitutional amendment on voter ID next session if they're allowed to, and send that to the voters. It's already passed once. So it's one of the really important reasons that we need to get the assembly majority this year, and we can't allow them to come back with that majority next time. They also are talking about an abortion ban. Surprising to me that they would do that in this political moment when they have seen how voters respond to their efforts to take away reproductive rights, but they continue on. And so we all know what they're up to. They're trying to get around Governor Evers, the popularly elected governor of Wisconsin, by passing these constitutional amendments. We just can't let them do it. We have to get the assembly majority this year.
So then what's the roadmap to getting that assembly majority then?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's just working very hard. Our candidates are doing great work. They are knocking on hundreds of doors every week. We have 52 seats that Governor Evers would have won if we'd had these maps in 22. We have 49 that Biden would have won, with three that he would have lost by half a percentage point. So the path is there. These voters have voted Democratic historically, and our candidates are going out to make sure that everyone both turns out and shows up for them. And so, again, our focus is making sure that those candidates are on the doors. That close margin, right, 2 percentage points, plus or minus for Biden, 10 seats in that category, those are numbers that you can shift by being on the doors and by working hard. Republicans have not done that because they have not needed to for 10 years. And so they're not used to getting out and doing the work and knocking on the doors and actually persuading voters. Their messages are not resonant with the people of Wisconsin. They don't have the grassroots infrastructure. The party is weak because Trump is pulling all of the dollars for himself. And on our side, we have a unified incredibly motivated and enthusiastic coalition that is going to do everything they can to flip the assembly this year, to win these critical Senate seats, congressionals, Tammy Baldwin, and then Kamala Harris in Texas.
Care to make a prediction for how this is going to go?
52.
That's the prediction.
That's the plan. Again, that's the seats Biden won, and then three he lost by half a percentage point. And we've got Yiling Zhang, Christy Welch, and Allison Page in those very, very close seats. These are really, really good candidates. These are people who came to us because they wanted to be part of this historic moment in Wisconsin, because they have been leaders in their local communities, and they want to govern. That's why they're running. And so they're doing everything they can to flip the assembly and to help us pass this great policy next year.
Very good. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah,
I have one other question that's been a little bit of a curiosity of mine.
Yeah, sure.
Since you've had this two-seat kind of buffer with the protecting the veto.
Yeah.
You know, I know there was one incident involving Representative Doyle from La Crosse area. Are there any other examples of that you can share about the lengths that you've all gone to protect that veto in these last 2 years?
Yes. So, pretty quickly after election night in 22, we realized how close the margins were going to be, that there was a Republican supermajority in the Senate. And then we were digging in on the rule changes that Republicans had made on their ability to take up veto overrides. Those meant that they could take up veto overrides as many times as they wanted, which was a change, and that they could make an argument. I guess what I'll say is that they might try to take up overrides in many different circumstances. So we were concerned they could try to take them up during skeletal session days in Madison when there had been no calendared session and no warning. And so I had to ask our members to be in Madison a lot over the last year and a half. They were in Madison for every skeletal session day. They were there for every hour that the Capitol was open. We had folks check in with us to let us know that they were in the building. We had we bought this thing called Pager Duty, which is essentially an alert system, so that we could get the message out to every member and staff member as quickly as possible. It calls you until you pick up the phone. It texts you and emails you until you confirm, I've got the message, I'm coming to the floor of the assembly. Thankfully, we did not have to use that. But our members were there every single skeletal session day and every single session day. And so we didn't have many close calls because people were there. They understood the assignment, and they missed, you know, their family funerals and birthdays, and many of them had part-time jobs that they really had to let go to the wayside because they had to be in Madison a lot. And that's the job. They understood that, but it was a lot. It was different than it has been in the past being in the assembly. And then, of course, there was one sort of dramatic incident, which was that Republicans thought they had the numbers. It was late at night, I think it was about 11 o'clock, and they were looking around, and they thought that they might be able to take up overrides, but Steve Doyle had been in his office all day because he had COVID. We made people come in and sit isolated in their offices with COVID because we needed them there. And so they started doing a call at the House to take up veto overrides, and Steve came running in his mask to make it clear that he was in fact there and they did not have the numbers.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
So they often, you know, so for those who don't follow this as closely, Republicans do often keep you in the dark about when those sessions are happening. Like how does that play out when you have that close of a majority and you have to, like, do they call things with, you know, whatever required notice that they have to give you and all that? I mean, how does that largely play out?
Yeah, so generally how it works is we will have a sense of when the session days are going to be. There's days held on the calendar, the skeletal days, and then they will let us know, you know, informally a few days before, and then sort of formally, you know, forgetting the exact notice, but a couple days. That's sort of the collegial way to do things. And then they would put things on the calendar so we'd have some time to prepare, right? Look at the bills, understand how we want to vote. our concern was that during these skeletal session days that were held, they might just walk onto the floor at any moment with absolutely no notice and start taking up veto overrides. We would have challenged that in court, but we didn't know if they would try to do that, and we couldn't allow them to have the opportunity to pass a bill on unfair maps and try to make an override, or attack trans kids and override, or, you know, this bad tax policies and override. So we just had to be there. And again, with the ability that they gave themselves, the Republicans gave themselves, to take up vetoes as many times as they want, we worried someone could be in the bathroom, right? Someone could have stepped outside to take a phone call and they take up veto overrides immediately. So everyone was tracking where all the members were at all times during session days to make sure that people would be able to run back and uphold the veto if needed.
Pretty wild. Yeah. Pretty wild. I bet you're looking forward to, you know, perhaps a style of governing that is a little bit different than
yes,
that.
Yes. You know, I had some Republican colleagues say, well, I wouldn't take up a veto override with no notice, but I'm not in charge.
Right.
So, you know, We'll see.
Seems like there's some within the Republican caucus that might want some new leadership, too.
Yeah, we'll hope that it's going to be a different time.
Yeah, well, very good. Thanks so much for all your time.
Yeah.